Hi there, this is Ron Myers and I'm one of the directors of the Consulting Room. And I'm delighted today to introduce Liz Bardolph, who I've known for many years, to discuss a really important topic related to consent and medical negligence. And as we're all hoping that clinics will begin to open again in the near future, it's going to be really important to remind both medical and especially non-medical practitioners of the importance of consent and repeat consent as part of the risk management process of running a clinic or salon. Liz originally trained as a nurse and has 20 years experience as a medical aesthetic practitioner with Cosmocare. And Liz is also multi-talented with a master's degree in medical law and has been an accredited aesthetic civil expert witness for over 10 years dealing with medical negligence cases in aesthetics. So Liz, welcome. And I just wanted to ask you, how's it been for you in lockdown?
Hi, good morning, Ron. Nice to speak to you. I've been busier than ever this lockdown. I've been keeping in touch with my own patients, which I think is terribly important. And I've now got somebody to help me with the marketing because I'm rubbish at marketing. So we've been sending out a survey to find out what the patients want, and we should be sending out newsletters. I'm also building a waiting list in anticipation of when we can open. And I really think that the earliest will be August, but we may have to put that back. But I thought I would put something in the diary so that we've all got something to work towards and so that I can keep in touch with everybody. So that and medical legal work for my other projects, I haven't had time to sit around thinking, oh, what shall I do next?
Yeah, it's similar for me as well. I've been really busy, and it's really great to hear that you are being so proactive, Liz. Because I know, and again, you've been at this a long while as well, and I know it'd be easy for someone like yourself as well to maybe just sit back a little bit and take a bit of rest. But I know how you work as well. You're always very forward thinking, and I think, you know, businesses like yourselves as well. You know, I think if you are keeping in touch with people, you are talking to them, and you are thinking about how you can better market your business, will come out the other end of this hopefully in better shape than some of the business that are just sitting back at this stage and just waiting for lockdown to end. So I do thank you for your time, because I know it's scarce. And what I wanted to do is kind of kick off with this for a start and look at what do both medical and non-medical practitioners need to consider with regard to the consent process when we can all get back to work again?
I do think they probably need to consider three questions. Does the patient know about the material risks? Does the particular patient know about the reasonable alternatives? And have I, as a practitioner, taken reasonable care to ensure that this patient is fully informed? And I think if you go into the consent process with those three questions in mind, then I think that will be building blocks for you to build up your consent process. Because quite honestly, the disclosure as risk is the area which is most problematic to all of us, really, as practitioners.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's three basic questions that you should have in your mind that you need to kind of come out of that process with some answers to.
I think so.
Brilliant. I think the interesting part as well that obviously I think is relevant for us to discuss as well is talking about the alternatives and how far you should go in talking about the alternatives.
I think that the alternatives need to be reasonable. I don't think you need to go through chapter and verse through absolutely everything. Remember, you're setting up a dialogue with the patient. It's a two-way discussion. It's not a tick box exercise. So you need to decide and decide with the patient what sort of things that they're looking for. And if there's a certain particular treatment that they're going to say no to because you've got that vibe already, there's no point in going into it. But just there must be reasonable alternatives. And of course, you must give the risks as well so that they can make up their mind.
That's fine. I suppose when you're thinking about alternatives, that could be, for instance, a surgical alternative versus a non-surgical, couldn't it? And if they'd said, I definitely don't want any surgery to correct this issue or problem, probably then you wouldn't necessarily go into that. Would that be right?
Absolutely right. Yes, okay. Yes. There's no point in bamboozling the patient with information that really he or she really doesn't need.
Yeah, okay, that's great. So how, as a practitioner, do you know if the patient or client has really understood what's been discussed?
I think you need to get the patient to reflect back to you in their own words what you've just said to them.
Okay.
That sort of reinforces what you've said, and also you as a practitioner will know whether or not the patient has fully understood it. And if the patient hasn't fully understood, then you can fill in the gaps.
Okay, that's great. What are the practitioner's responsibilities with regards to answering questions from clients or patients?
I don't think there's any good expecting a patient just to automatically answer questions, ask questions rather.
Yeah.
Because they don't know what they don't know. So you've really got to lead them into to answering questions. The onus is on us as practitioners to find out what the patient wants to know. It's not up to the patient to ask the question. We've got to be proactive with it. Again, it's setting up this discussion and getting to know your patient.
So in other words, really what you're trying to do is to help them become informed about something that quite clearly many people really don't know what, as you said, what they necessarily should be asking about particular treatments or procedures or solutions.
Yeah, that's right. And some patients are very well informed because they've used the internet, but some patients really don't have a clue at all. They've come to you absolutely cold, so you've got a blank canvas. And of course, if you're giving patients a lot of new information, it's very difficult to retain. You know, some of the words are unusual, some of them may be a bit long, even if you do try and explain them. You know, getting a patient to retain new information, as you know yourself, is not easy.
Yeah, okay, that's good. So what are the practitioner's responsibilities then with regards to documentation? What should they document and in what format?
Record keeping and documentation is all part and parcel of the consent process. And I think the practitioner must record the details of the consent process, including the risks and the options that have been discussed in the clinical notes. Because lawyers will be looking for evidence there has been a meaningful dialogue and it hasn't been a tick box exercise. So you've actually written down what you've said. That would help enormously should things go sour and should litigation ensue.
Okay, great. Well, that's good advice. So basically, if it's not written down, it's very hard to evidence what was discussed.
It's very hard indeed, yes.
Okay. Right, Liz. So can you just remind us as well of the legal requirements concerning consent and repeat consent as well?
There are four main legal requirements to consent. And these were clarified and redefined in a particular case known as Montgomery versus Lancashire Health Board in 2015. They didn't change the consent process, but they did clarify it and shifted the focus from the patient autonomy and partnership and away from paternalism, which was a doctrine which was gradually disappearing anyway. So that the four pillars really are: the procedure must be explained, the alternatives to be discussed, and we've already touched on that.
Yeah.
The risks are to be discussed, and questions to be answered truthfully, and we've talked about questions as well.
Okay. Fine.
I read in an article in a BMJ several years ago that there was quite a useful synonym for this. It was procedures, alternatives, risks, and questions. Mm-hmm. And you can break that down to capital letters, PARQ. And that's actually quite easy to remember, PARQ. And if you go through all those, then you've covered everything.
Oh, that sounds excellent. So it's quite an easy thing to kind of keep in your head then, isn't it? That I like that.
Yeah, park. Great.
Park, P-A-R-Q, lovely. And also, yeah. just from a technical perspective, is the Boland test still relevant to the consent process?
Not any longer, no. It's been overtaken by the Montgomery because of this patient autonomy. The Boland test asks if the doctor's conduct would be supported by a responsible body of medical opinion, in effect allowing the medical profession to arbitrate. The defence won't succeed even if those that support the defence are in the minority, as long as they're not irresponsible, not respectable or incompetent. So the Boland test has been completely replaced in respect of the consent process by Montgomery, which is patient-centred, i.e. was the patient made aware of the material risks and of any reasonable alternatives? We keep coming back to these two points, risks and alternatives.
Right, okay, fine. Okay, that's brilliant. Thank you. Do you have any other tips or information that you'd like to give our listeners concerning the consent process?
I think that's probably covered it. It's just I think we all need to remember that non-medics and medics, the law of negligence applies to all of us. We touched on bombarding the patient with information. I think, yeah, what we need to say is even if the risk is statistically low for the particular patient you've got in front of you, mm-hmm. it may be high. So that's worth remembering. For okay. instance, bruising if they're in the public eye. You know, some people won't bat an eyelid if they're going to be bruised for a day or so, but yeah. there will be others who will not be very impressed. I think you also need to tell practitioners need to tell patients about less serious complications if they occur frequently. For instance, prolonged swelling, lumps and bumps. People get pretty upset if this happens and they're not well warned properly about it.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I suppose it's then also looking at the very rare but also serious complications. So, I mean, one of those is in relation to dermal fillers, which probably 15 years ago nobody would have discussed, but now is well documented, and that's potential blindness.
Yeah, I do think this need to be mentioned, does need to be mentioned. You know, it's statistically low, but it hasn't. And I think really it is something we've got to broach with our patients. After all, these treatments aren't essential. Yeah. You know, they are. They may be essential for some people in some ways, but you know what I mean, that they're not medically essential. So I think it may perhaps put some people off if you tell them that there is the possibility of this particular complication or even a vascular occlusion.
Mm-hmm.
I know, I've discussed this with some patients, certainly for lip augmentations, and the youngsters, it's made them think twice. Do I really want to go ahead with this?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is it, and I think it's, again, it's providing people with all of the information that is relevant to that situation, isn't it, really? And then it's up to them to make their, as you say, an informed decision as to whether they want to go ahead or not.
Absolutely, yes.
Lovely. All right. Well, thank you, Liz. That's been really, really useful. I wish you all the best of luck over the next sort of few weeks. And let's all hope that we can start to get some sort of normality, whatever that will be, again soon.
It would be very nice to get back to seeing patients. I have to say, I do miss them.
Yeah. Lovely. Thank you, Liz. Thanks for your time. Bye.
Thank you, Ron. Bye-bye.